Welcome to Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today, I am joined by David L. Bonson, founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer at the Bonson Group, overseeing $5.3 billion in client assets. We'll be discussing his book, Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. Mr. Bonson, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Where is the best place for people to purchase this book?
Well, I try to be agnostic about where they get it. We have links to both Amazon and Barnes & Noble on the fulltimebook.com website. But for those who are still old school that like to walk into a bookstore, it's pretty much sold wherever fine books are sold as well. So whether brick and mortar or online, it's pretty readily available.
Sounds good. Let's get into the materials. In the book, you say one of the clearest economic principles is that production plays a powerful role in driving prosperity in a society. Pro-work ideology connects to economic life in a myriad of ways. What does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, essentially, in layman's terms, production could be thought of as equivalent to work. When we think about consuming things in an economy, when we're enjoying services that we enjoy, when we're buying goods that we enjoy, we are partaking of things that before we consumed them were produced. Production precedes consumption. This is a tautology. It's self-evidently true. The miraculous part of the leverage in this economically is that you get two parts production for every one part consumption. And what I mean by that is I can't consume something until I have produced and have the means to consume it. And I can't consume something unless somebody else produced it. And so you're generating economic growth through the production of goods and services. Now, of course, goods and services are not produced for the purpose of being thrown away. They're produced for the purpose of eventually being consumed, but production has to drive consumption. And in fact, even when somebody produces something that the customer doesn't like, no matter what, they learn from that and rechannel resources. This is the most Hayekian principle of all, and of course was really out of the classical school, even pre-Austrian economics with Jean-Baptiste Say, that even production that ends up being rejected by the consumer is productive in the sense that it rechannels productive activity to something more resourceful, something that will ultimately be more profitable. That whole engine of economics is very, very important, and it is all a matter of work. When we talk about all this productive activity as a driver of economics, trial and error, the physical labor that can go into things, the ideation, the ingenuity, the risk-taking, these things are best expressed in the very easy-to-understand four-letter word, the verb work.
There is a general claim I'd like you to respond to this idea. Work is a means to accessing products and services, not an end in and of itself. What, if anything, is wrong with that mindset?
Well, first of all, how does one access goods and services apart from somebody else producing them? So if one says, my work was done so that I can access your goods and services, was that person's production of goods and services done only so they could access somebody else's? Or is there a God-given purpose in creating the goods and services that others end up consuming? This isn't binary. It is all a positive feedback loop. I, as a producer, have tastes and preferences of what I will consume. And others who are producing the things I will consume also have their own taste and preferences. And when you then add on a few billion people to the mix and a wide array of categories and sectors and products and whatnot, you get a very complex economy that nevertheless miraculously works out of a sort of spontaneous order of us all simultaneously enjoying the things we consume, but also finding meaning and purpose and dignity in producing the things others will consume. So I think that formulation, it's not as much that it's inaccurate as that it's incomplete.
How can we differentiate productive worth, productive work from unproductive work?
Well, productive work is work done towards an object. And so all I mean by that is it is extended into space for the purpose of meeting a human need. And it is quite true that we have people who believe certain needs are more important than others. Someone who picks up trash off of the ground at an amusement park is considered to be doing low human needs. And someone who is inventing a search engine like Google is considered to be doing a high human need. I would rather distinguish that based on market pricing, that there is a higher education, skill, technical, capital investment, expertise there, that certain needs get met with higher barrier to entry than others. But I don't believe that this category is different. Both picking up the trash and creating technological innovations, both are done to meet human needs. So in that sense, all work is done productively. And if someone says a certain job is unproductive, then I would argue it isn't work. It doesn't meet the definition, because I'm defining work tautologically, that it is the production of goods and services that meet the needs of humanity. Now, can government get involved and make work less productive? Can they misallocate resources? They certainly can. And this is very important language for those of us who have a more conservative formulation of government role in the economy. That is to say, a very low and limited role. However, I still think there, by category, you're referring to them making some of these work efforts suboptimal, not necessarily completely unproductive. And so as a basic definition, I would argue that work is always productive.
Okay. So we can differentiate from productive work and unproductive work when we're not talking about meeting human needs. I will hear about, people working very hard and that being good in and of itself. Like, well, I'm sure there's a lot of thieves and kidnappers and traffickers who work extremely hard. But according to your definition, that is not what we're talking about. That's why I'm glad you got a nice, consistent way for us to approach this. When it comes to work, have you found that there is a correlation between wealth and happiness?
When it comes to work or when it comes to wealth?
Just when it comes to wealth accumulation in general.
Well, I think that there is a, in a sense, a category distinction between the accumulation of goods and services and happiness in the immaterial realm. I generally believe that there is a certain baseline of material needs that are quite important to a facilitation of happiness, a general level of health, food, shelter, water, warmth, the things that facilitate survival. But I most certainly, as a man of faith, believe that one can have tremendous material prosperity and be spiritually impoverished. And I believe that people can be reasonably materially limited and still be spiritually rich. So I don't think that those things have a necessary correlation. What I do believe, though, is that the optimal environment is one in which material needs are being met, productive activity is being done, and that is feeding the human spirit. It is fueling the conditions of human fulfillment, of the good life. And I think that that understanding of human flourishing is the only consistent one I've ever studied that both seeks to address mankind's material and immaterial needs.
So the thesis of this book is work is the meaning of life, correct?
Yes, it is.
And that doesn't necessarily mean work you're getting compensated for. This could be internships. This could be stay-at-home work where one spouse takes care of the kids and does housework, and the other might get monetary income from other work. So we're not necessarily talking about work in exchange for monetary goods, correct?
That's correct. The only caveat I'd give is that the focus of the book was primarily in a context of vocational work, but by the very definition I gave you a moment ago, the production of goods and services meet needs of humanity, there's absolutely no requirement to be compensatory work. I think where we have in the current moment in society a rather vivid crisis is specific to professional work, vocational work, and so forth, that there is a downward trend in our society's relationship to work that I think goes against much of the American ethos and tradition. But I absolutely agree with what you just said, that the thesis of my book and the philosophy I have does not require the work in terms of extracting purpose and dignity to be compensated work.
I was having a conversation with a gentleman some time ago who talked about how he's really proud of, you know, this great accounting job that he has. And, you know, some time went by and I think he got a few drinks in him. And he just told me that he actually made this up. He doesn't work at an accounting organization. He works at Goodwill and was really, really ashamed of that. And I asked him, well, what is so hard about, what is so terrible about working at a place like Goodwill? So before I did tell you what my takeaway from that was, how can someone who is more or less ashamed of their current position find meaning in the work that they do?
Well, I think that that's sort of the essence of the whole book, that there is a necessary philosophy to adopt before being able to see it that way. If one views work as something done to achieve socioeconomic strata, then I think it would be very hard for some people in various occupational contexts to feel that pride. Of course, the whole point is work is not something we do to achieve, or merely work is not something we merely do to achieve economic strata. That if I believe work is a God-given purpose, and that in fact work was something that was created by God to mirror Him and reflect the fact that we are bearers of His image, then whether one is working in a position that society puts a lot of status on or not, we have very ample reason to find both joy and fulfillment out of it. Now, I also talk a great deal in the book about the reality of a journey in one's life, that if one, it's so cliche, it makes it useful to use as an example. One who aspires to be a successful theater actor or actress on Broadway very rarely gets their first gig right upon arriving in New York City, where I'm sitting right now, and very rarely is receiving the money necessary to support themselves. So the cliche of one working as a waiter or waitress while they're waiting for that Broadway career to develop is kind of a cliche for a reason. Do I think that one should look at those years spent, risk-taking years, waiting tables at a diner to try to make it on Broadway, as a negative or as a blessed part of the journey? I would argue that for most people that end up achieving a certain degree of professional success, they almost always find, this is absolutely true of my own journey, that the early years with the most struggle were the most blessed years, the most rewarding, the journey itself becoming the prize, not merely the destination.
That is a great takeaway. I remember getting, I just needed a job when I was younger. So I got one at Walmart online grocery pickup. And I was kind of embarrassed that I'd had a good job at a bank before and lost that job. But at Walmart, I would spend half the day shopping for customers and the other day the other half of the day, delivering groceries to people's cars. And I made them so happy that I was more fulfilled there than I was at this job that I couldn't stop bragging about. I'd had a job at a credit union that I thought was so cool. But when you're directly creating value for value in these exchanges, it really helps you. And when you're exhausted at the end of the day, I felt so much more fulfilled. Same with my current position. All right, here's one for you. Work is a place of simple exploitation. The owners extract wealth from the workers, only employing them knowing they can make money off of their actions. Therefore, work should not be admired. How do you respond?
Well, I mean, it's certainly an almost verbatim quote from Karl Marx. That is the fundamental tenet of Marxism. And it is undergirded by Marx's commitment to the labor theory of value, that the only value we get in goods and services is the labor that was imputed to it. And the great takeaway of the classical school of economics, and really Karl Menger did some phenomenal work here at the Austrian school, now it's just taken for granted, it's so obvious, that there is a subjective theory of value. Why is a particular table good? Is it because of all the hands and tools that went into making it? Or is it because the person likes it, who buys it? And so if somebody works very, very, very hard at making a really, really bad and ugly table, does the table have value or not? Is the value of the table correlated to the labor that went into it? So we end up discovering a rather obvious fact in human living that value comes from customer preferences, subjective taste of a very diversified humanity, and that one person's love of a particular painting is going to be totally different than another person's love of a car stereo system and so forth and so on. And out of this, we realize that the notion of one's labor being equivalent to the value in a product is a self-defeating idea. That if there is not profit out of the product that the labor creates, then there can be no incentive for capital investment to create the products, ergo, no room for the labor. So that the labor and capital are always and forever in a market economy in a positive feedback loop together. But where I believe there's a just very basic takeaway here, even apart from my sort of deeper Marxian critique about labor theory of value, is I believe that what the worker is selling is essentially profitable as well. They're doing a free exchange with an employer saying, I will come work for you and I want this wage. And the employer can say, no, I'll pay you this, or yes, I'll pay you that. But they get to essentially engage in a market transaction around the value of their own labor. And in that sense, become the entrepreneur, making a decision around what they could do with their time and talent. And then from that, the entrepreneur who has also put risk-taking capital into the mix and organized the projects, hired other employees and so forth, they have their various set of risk-reward trade-offs at play. One laborer's risk-reward trade-off, it becomes a series of risk-reward trade-offs in the product getting manufactured. This is a beautiful thing. But the notion that some workers are exploited or mistreated, that they are lied to, you know, all of these things require category distinction. I vehemently oppose employers treating employees badly. I vehemently oppose fraud, but I vehemently support the right of employees to freely negotiate with employers themselves what they're willing to sell their time and talent for.
All I heard from Democrats and progressives when I was younger was, we need to legalize gay marriage. You might not like it. You might think it's terrible. You might not engage in it, but you still have to respect those people's rights to do with their life what they want. They never applied this to the economic realm. Do you have any idea what how they justify some, you know, gaping contradiction?
Well, I think it is for them not a contradiction, because the root premise behind it is that they view the world through the prism of class struggle. And so if you believe that history is a story of an oppressed and an oppressor, and then draw a narrative to essentially have to move around who those oppressed groups may be, that's kind of the story we're living through now. Marx obviously drew up his tenets around the oppressed being defined by class. And the more modern cultural Marxism is using race and gender far more frequently in the same narrative of class struggle than they are economic class, the class divide. But all of it is just from a flawed view of history, misunderstands the anthropology that is necessary to get this right, the dignity of the human person, and the dignity not coming from their belonging to a collective. So Rousseau screwed all of this up. Marx just doubled down. And now in the 21st century, we're living through an era of not learning the lessons of the 20th century.
What are some misconceptions people have about the word profit? What is profit, and is it inherently good, inherently bad? Is it a neutral term? What are your thoughts on this?
Profit is inherently good when it's properly defined, but profit is the gain that comes from the process of economic transaction. And so essentially, because of subjective value, I have bubble gum on the playground, but what I really want is the baseball card my friend has, and he really wants the bubble gum I have and doesn't care so much about the baseball card. We can exchange things, and there are no new products. All we did was exchange two things, but we're both better off. In other words, we're both wealthier. What we have now in goods and services accumulated is worth more to us for the simple reason that one person doesn't need a cow and one person doesn't need water. But when cow and water get traded, both people have needs met that make them better off. And so six-year-olds seem to understand this idea with bubblegum and baseball cards better than grown adults that get elected to the halls of Congress seem to understand it. Profit is a process by which economic calculation is done, goods and services are produced, and the people involved end up better off. And that is a process we call profit making.
Got it. The book is Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. Here we have a tweet from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I want to get your response to this mindset. She says, "It is utterly embarrassing that pay people enough to live is a stance that's even up for debate. Override the parliamentarian and raise the wage. McDonald's workers in Denmark are paid $22 an hour plus 6 weeks paid vacation, $15 an hour. Is a deep compromise, a big one, considering the phase in." What is your response to this?
Well, I wonder if she believes that $22 an hour is a livable wage for a mother of three in Midtown Manhattan. Now, again, this forces us to go into an arbitrariness, but I would rather not start with that argument that once you believe the government can set wages, why stop at 22? It lacks limiting principle. But we have to start with two other principles that end the whole conversation. Number one is that the minimum wage is always and forever $0. That what she is talking about is pricing out anyone in the delta between where the value to the employer is less than that wage level being set by the disinterested third party named AOC. So if I believe that I need 100 people to do a certain thing, and there's margins and all the calculation I'm doing in my business, and I believe the work is worth $14 an hour to me, they set the wage at 22, I have no choice but to not hire the people that will force me below that marginal value. Now, the other issue here, besides the fact that she's guaranteeing unemployment, is it's rooted by her argument in a premise that is obviously untrue, which is that all work is supposed to be a livable wage. A lot of work, including the example she gave, is ideally suited for part-time workers who don't need a livable wage, namely high school teenagers that for years and years and years did work part-time work in summer and after school, or college students that did supplement themselves going through school with hourly wage, like at a McDonald's, waiting tables, other such work. So what she has done all at once is not only not create a livable wage for those of lower skill and education, she has priced many of them out of the market altogether, compounding the problem and making them more dependent on a social safety net, and limited teenage employment, which is itself a wonderful feeding ground to people being more gainfully employable later in life as they learn basic skills, showing up, discipline, getting along with coworkers, taking instructions from a boss, things like that. So these elevated minimum wage laws are not even really well-intentioned anymore. It's political rhetoric to sound as if you're trying to do something that you're not even able to do. And we see this in real time across the board, publicly traded fast food restaurants that are paying a higher hourly wage now are paying lower total wages across the whole company. The reason is that they are able to get more productivity hiring less people as a result of the incentive that these things created for them to go automate and use technology for more efficiency. This is a direct byproduct of their hand being forced by bad policy.
Exactly. That they'll tell us all day long about how, you know, if you raise the price of goods, well, that hurts the poor. However, raising the cost of employing people, well, that just has no downside. That just benefits people. It's amazing. The same thing applies every single time.
That's right.
The other tweet that I came across that when I was going through your book is this one. It says, "This to me is worse than death." And it is a typical image of a desk job. So when you're making the case that work is the meaning of life, and some people have such a hoodwinked idea, or whenever they think of work, this is what they think of: solitude, meaningless, just doing what it takes to get by. What do you say to this mindset?
Well, if somebody thinks that working a cubicle is worse than death, I would encourage them to be very careful in an automobile. I would encourage them to really be, you know, safe in the day-to-day decisions they make in their life. They may very well find that such language is unhelpful and perhaps not appreciated by people that actually do risk life and limb on a daily basis. But just so we're clear, if somebody thinks that working in a cubicle is undesirable and they have the maturity to not say it's worse than death, they just say they don't want that job, then don't take a job in a desk. How's that? Go work with your hands, go paint, go find someone who wants to hear you play violin, go teach in a classroom, go work in a factory. In a market economy with a division of labor and specialization and optionality we have, it is incomprehensible that someone needs to apply their own preference for what they believe may be worse than death to all of the rest of us. I recommend that the person saying things like that probably grow up to some degree, but also realize that it's very easily solved. Don't go work in a desk if you don't want to work in a desk.
And say that I currently have this job. I'm miserable. I just go to the office and I want another job, but I feel like my options are limited. What steps can I take? Of course, as always, deregulate at the federal level, increase competition, abolish the minimum wage. Of course, I agree with all those. Assume that that Congress isn't taking my calls now, and all I have are the capacities of a computer, I have a car, I can do some things in my capacity. What can I do to increase my value as a worker, to increase the likelihood that employers will desire me as an employee?
Well, I think that that on a micro level is going to be very different profession by profession. I mean, I think that all people, the universal principles are being more industrious, being harder working, being more committed. There's virtues that apply. Virtues, for the most part, represent some of the greatest job security out there. Somebody who's very good at a task and lacks virtue is oftentimes going to be less employable than someone who's okay at a task but has virtue. But of course, that presupposes that one of the virtues is to get better at the task. So there is a sort of self-reinforcing mechanism here. I believe in the virtue of self-improvement, you know, resilience, tenacity, et cetera. But in individual sectors, there's different things that help people differentiate themselves even more. And that's the beauty of a market economy, is that what one has to do to develop a competitive edge in technology is different than what one has to do in finance. There are some businesses that really require great people skills, and those honing their relationship skills is a huge value add in their role in the marketplace. And there's other aspects in their economic life and where that one's technical prowess is going to be more important. And so I think people have to identify what the value proposition is of the line of work they're interested in. And then, as we read about in for the Apostle Paul, run in a way the race in a way to win. Beat your body and make it your slave so that you can go out and be successful in the race. And I think when people pick a career path, they need to commit themselves to that kind of tenacity. That's what I believe in my message of full-time work as the meaning of life.
I want to briefly go over some disparities in income when it comes to work. According to the census of 2018, the highest income groups are Indian Americans, Taiwanese Americans, Chinese, Japanese, Pakistani Americans, Filipino, Indonesian, Korean, Cambodian, Hmong, Vietnamese, and then white Americans and black Americans. What is it that these groups are doing differently to create such disparities in income?
Well, I don't know enough to be able to answer that in terms of the specifics behind the study, what the data inputs are, what timelines are involved. We do know at a high level that Asian Americans often are entering the workforce with a higher degree of education, and particularly math science. And so there has been a lot of new hiring in STEM-related fields. I tend, as an economist, to be more interested in some of these data points at a bottom-up level. What are the unique micro components that enable someone of any color or demographic or whatnot to flourish in a particular industry? But on a top-down basis, there are demographic trends, educational trends, immigration trends, et cetera, that all impact those things. But it's not an area, a specific study that I have looked at. For example, when you refer to Native American, for example, there generally are answers. There generally are various trends that one could go look at to find some cause and effect. But I find myself a little bit more focused on the micro there than the macro.
Got it. So say that I have the mindset of I really identify with the working class, people who spend a great deal of their time working, and I care about the workers. Why should I support something like a market economy as opposed to a state-run economy?
So is your question, do I think that people should prefer individually less of a state-run economy in order for them to have more opportunity for advancement?
Definitely the way to approach it. I just come across so many people who say, well, I really care about the workers. And that is just the ultimate claim that, well, that's why I justify a big state. It doesn't even need further explanation. It's the reason I advocate such a big government is because I care about the workers, which means you people who don't advocate a big state, you don't care about the workers. That mindset in general, I'd like you to respond to.
Well, sure. And I think in that case, I'm at a point where it isn't particularly offensive to me, but I do recognize that I'm not necessarily contending with a real argument. You're contending with someone who would prefer to use virtue signaling and good intention and a certain degree of emotion as a substitute for an argument. And if they want, if it's in good faith, I would like to have the discussion and I'd like to do so charitably. But what I would point out is, are we after feeling good about ourselves, or are we after something that is actually better for workers? Where has there been the largest level of state involvement in an economy in history? And have those places with the largest level of state involvement been places that have been good for workers or bad for workers? And when we say good for workers, do we mean human beings only in their capacity as workers, or human beings holistically? You know, one of the things we could do that'd be great for workers is demand that every worker be paid $1 million per year. I think every worker would love that. I'm not so sure every consumer would like that. And yet, I think most consumers are workers and most workers are consumers. So doing economic analysis around how it affects one group and not another group, how it affects people in the short term but not the long term, and how it affects things visibly but not invisibly, is the basic definition of economic fallacy. This is Friedrich Bastiat 101. You have to look at how the visible and invisible effects, short term and long term, and the effects on the many, not just the few. And ultimately, when people talk about policies they believe will be pro-worker, if we dig into this enough, there is a 100% chance that we will find where the thumb of the government has been largest, the impact on those who are workers has been the worst. And that where we allow for conditions of freedom and opportunity to flourish in an aspirational society, then opportunities for workers have been the greatest. But I would very gladly embrace the premise of that person saying, I want what's best for worker, by saying, I want what's best for worker too. I would merely insist upon defining the worker as one aspect of a human being, and that there are a number of other ways that we have to measure what is best for a worker, and conditions of freedom and opportunity, I believe, time and time again, maximize those conditions.
I love that answer. Thank you so much. I remember being blown away reading Race and Economics by Walter Williams, where he said, Since, obviously, disparities in unemployment are the result of racism. So let's go back to 1948, when there was much more racism, and let's look at youth unemployment between blacks and whites. And it turns out whites had a higher youth unemployment rate at that time when there was far more racism. I go, it never even occurred to me that we could actually falsify a thesis like this. And every time, more regulation, more costs of operating businesses mean people with the least amount of skills will be able to get their foot in the door and have opportunities within the economy. That's right. I loved your previous book as well, 250 Economic Truths. This is a collection of quotes. Can you give me two or three of your favorite economists of all time and something you, the biggest takeaway you had from those economists?
Sure. So the book was called There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths. And, limiting it to two or three is very difficult, but one could probably guess by counting up the levels, the numbers of quotes, you know, from some of the different economists. I obviously had a very heavy hand behind Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, and Adam Smith in the book, but Thomas Sowell would have to be up there as well. I've been extremely impacted by a lot of economists. I'd probably say I have about a dozen that are in my sort of Hall of Fame. I would include Schumpeter, I'd include Ludwig von Mises, I would include a number of contemporaries as well. But all of them, even of different points of emphasis, whether one is more focused on monetary economics, one more in political economy, And oftentimes, I think, like Adam Smith, a moral philosopher, what they share is generally tremendous, profound insights about the human person and about social cooperation, how humans interact with one another in the real world. And that is, I think, the story of economics, is understanding the human person, human nature, and how that manifests itself in the way we allocate scarcity. So it's the study, it's the passion of my life, the study of this field. And one could do a lot worse than look into some of those names I offered. But would I say favorite two or three, Hayek, Friedman, and Smith? Sure, on any given day. But then on another day, I can't put Thomas Sowell down and so forth. Peter Behcke today is one I enjoy reading a great deal. You know, there's quite a few wonderful resources available. You mentioned Walter Williams a moment ago, and sometimes rereading some of his stuff, I'm utterly blown away at what a national treasure Walter Williams was.
All right. So if we had to summarize our discussion, by the way, again, the book is Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. You claim there is a crisis of despair. What is the cause of this despair? Give us the takeaway of this book and how people can find meaning in negative spaces.
Well, I believe that the crisis of despair at a high level that we face in the society goes deeper than merely a declining view of work. Unfortunately, many others are diagnosing the crisis of despair as being caused by too much work and too much need to work and too much stress in work. But I believe the crisis of despair comes from the four major categories of human joy being somewhat suppressed or limited. And that is our connection to faith, family, friends, and work. And I think that we have a downward pressure on transcendent truth in society, faith, a declining understanding of the institution of family, a total disregard for the binds in a community and social fabric that is represented in friendships. And so those three elements are all at the heart of the despair. But then the fourth component is the one that not only is, I think, contributing to the despair, a low view of work, but it is being heralded as a part of the problem, that work is contributing to the despair as opposed to the lack of work. So in that sense, I view work not as a part of the problem, but as a part of the solution. And I think that what I mean by that is not merely someone getting off their butt and getting up and going to a job, although that language sometimes has its place and can be an important task once someone gets to a point of too much complacency. But really, I'm sharing this as more of a positive message, that embedded in work is us exercising our God-created purpose from which we find dignity, that we have our needs met by meeting the needs of others and enter into a virtuous cycle that becomes a true source of joy in our lives.
The book is Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. My guest today is David L. Bonson. Mr. Bonson, thank you so much for your time. Get the book in the description below. Take care.
Thanks so much.